Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to Retro Anatomy of a Movie. I'm Christian Blatt, and our usual round of co-hosts, Rachel Goodman, Alexa Capiello. I think that they're under quarantine, suspected of the coronavirus, which will be a really, really dated reference when people go back to watch this. But sure. It seemed funny in my head at the time. But filling in, hey, the wonderful,
thank you,
Flobo Boys, Flobito.
Hey, Flobo.com. Thank you
DJ
so much.
DJ Flobo.
That's true.
House.
That's true. Thank you so much. First time on the network. So first time on the show, too. Thanks so much for inviting
me. Absolutely.
I think I'm coronavirus free. So yeah, that's always good.
Yeah, if there's a cough, I'm going to have Ryan Yankee out
right,
of here.
Right.
I'll do the rest of the show by myself. In any case, just tell people a little bit about yourself.
Sure.
And we'll dive into Annie Hall in a moment.
That's true. I am a big wrestling fan on the other AfterBuzz TV network. I also do the Monday Night Raw and NXT after shows, but I'm a lover of films, film school graduate from Chapman University right here in Southern California just a couple years ago as an editor. So I'm always about the story and shaping story with footage and all that. So I have seen a lot of movies in the filmography of Woody Allen, but this is my first time watching Annie Hall.
Yeah, same here. And there's a few that I've really enjoyed. I think Crimes and Misdemeanors is amazing. And
Bulls Over Broadway.
Bulls Over Broadway, absolutely. And then, you know, some of the more recent ones, a little bit more hit or miss, but Blue Jasmine was great. So it's interesting to just kind of go back and, yeah, like, well, you know that this one's great. You hear that. But for whatever reason, we had never seen it.
Yes.
And that's the whole point of what this Retro Anatomy of a Movie is. It's movies that we haven't seen. We don't know why. It's not a conscious effort. There's never been the moment where somebody's like, hey, do you want to see Annie Hall? And I said, nope.
Right. Get that away from me.
I can't
possibly, yeah.
My wife had seen it and it turned out owned the DVD. So it was very easy. I didn't have to see where it was streaming. I didn't have to look for anything.
You didn't get in trouble, did you? She was like, we saw that one time.
No. Okay. She owned it from before we met.
Okay.
So it's all right.
Okay,
you know.
Cool.
So, yeah. And so that's what we do here. And, you know, when we were kind of going back and forth about movies that neither of us had seen, I thought, what with the Oscars coming up a week from Sunday, so about a week and a half. Yeah, they're a little early this year.
Yeah.
Let's go with a film that did quite well in 1977.
True.
So one of the things we like to do is kind of put it into context for how it was celebrated at the time. For me, I have no excuse as to why I didn't see it. It just never quite happened. I remembered seeing a little bit at one point, you know, on some movie channel on cable, probably 20 years ago. And here's the thing. If I turn on a movie I haven't seen and it's not the beginning, or the little on-screen thing doesn't say started like 2 minutes ago, I'm like, I can't.
Right.
I'm Woody in the movie.
Yeah, I was like, wait a minute. That sounds
a little
familiar. Yeah.
No, I'm like, I'm not going to start this movie for the first time, you know, 20 minutes
in. Is 2 minutes you cut off, though?
I just guess.
I'm saying, is it 5, 10 minutes?
You know, it depends
or
on what the movie is. And also, like, honestly, you go to a movie today, you get 25 minutes of trailers.
True.
So it's fine. But in general, you know, I'm like, oh, I just, so that's really what happened. I saw a little of it. I'm like, okay, this is clearly a Woody Allen movie because there he is. And I'm like, I'm going to watch this another time. And that another time wasn't until last night.
Okay.
So what about you?
Yeah. So my background is I was a news editor first, and I applied to film school here at Chapman University.
Sure.
And they gave me a list of 75 films you had to watch before you got admitted. This is way back when I moved to California.
Yeah, sure.
And so you hack and Citizen Kane, fine, Bridge Over Kwai, great. And it got to the end of that list and I was running on fumes, man. I was like, look, school starting in a week. I'll get to you, Annie Hall, later. And it never did.
Never did.
And what's funny is that there's so many films that come out after that saying, oh, it's the Annie Hall for this generation or this demographic or this country, that I figured, okay, I guess I kind of seen it. There's no urgency to go back to the granddaddy of them all until 2 days ago when I saw it the first time.
So, yeah, that's kind of what we're bringing to this. Now, Flobo, I know that I gave you a little homework to look up what kind of awards and recognition the film got in its heyday, which is 1977.
Does that predate most of your friend network? most of your friends before 1977?
I was born 1976, so I do. I've got some people
in the nursery.
Some people that go back. It's really just, you know, my parents and my brother, but still, you know, my cousins and stuff. So you know what? I've got family that far back. Yeah.
Winner of 4 Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress in a Leading Role, and Best Original Screenplay. With Woody Allen taking the Best Director role.
Sure.
And of course, 1 Golden Globe and about 5 BAFTAs. So this thing, when it came out at the time, was already revered. It wasn't a cult following or anything. It was that celebrated.
Yeah, and it's great because it's the 70s in a lot of ways. You know, when people talk about the golden age of Hollywood, they're not talking about the 70s, but it is sort of the auteur era where, like, writer directors, their vision realized on the screen is like, well, that's what was winning. So it's great to see that this story, even though, yes, 43 years ago, was recognized. And you feel like today it would be like, oh, it was cute. But, you know, it's not a best picture. But it was so revolutionary for its time. And as Ryan in the booth made sure that I was well aware, which I did not need to be reminded what year Star Wars came out, this one best picture of the year Star Wars came out. I think genre films, especially back then, never had a chance. I think now they don't have much of a chance either.
Right.
They get nominated because there's more. But, you know, I think even in 2021, a hypothetical Star Wars movie and a hypothetical Woody Allen movie came, were both nominated. I would put my money on the Woody Allen movie before the Star Wars movie. It's the way that Hollywood views itself.
It's funny you mentioned the new Hollywood period, that time in the mid to late 70s with so many auteurs and doing Francis Ford Coppola and all that. It just says a lot about Woody Allen's longevity in his career. I mean, he took a very concerted effort early on to say, I'm writing and directing and starring in my stuff, or writing and directing my stuff. But the fact that he's able to change and even decide to say, hey, look, it can't be about me all the time.
Yeah.
There's a new crop of actors and actresses to fill in
his
roles.
It took him a little while.
Yeah, it took him a little while, but he made that decision.
But like at this point, it's great. And then there's also just the simple fact that in the movie, he's talking about how he's 40. And I'm like, oh, my God, you're only 40 in this? And then I'm like, wait a minute, are you in your mid-80s now?
Yeah.
How old is he? And the worst part of all of that is I'm like, oh, I'm older than Woody Allen in this movie because I'm going to be 44 in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how am I old? And I've only been married once.
Right.
And he'd been married twice. So he got so much, you know, he accomplished. I'm talking about his character, obviously, in the film. So, but I don't know. I find it to be a very relatable story. Sure, there's certainly ways in which it is set in a very specific time. You know, it is certainly a product of the mid-70s and of New York, where we are both from.
Yeah.
And it's always great to see New York from the 70s because it's a disaster. They talk about it in the film multiple times that it's a dying city. I mean, people were fleeing the five boroughs to move out to the country, basically the country suburbs where I grew up.
Right.
I mean, you know, every year there would be a couple more, you know, tough guys. I'm like, well, you're tough because you're out at this school, but you weren't so tough that you could still live in the city.
Yeah.
You know,
see, it's kind of ironic because my parents came to the country in the mid-70s because of the movie demographic. So the housing market totally crashed and there was a time where we were like, what's going to happen? It's going to get any worse. There was talk about a super criminal coming in the late 70s. So there really was this fear around
that
time.
Well, yeah, Lex Luthor in 1978.
Exactly.
That was the super criminal we were all worried about. He's the greatest criminal mind in the 20th century.
Clutching his hands and all that stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But the idea that, you know, New York is dirty, but California we'll talk about. It's this nice, clean utopia where things go right, which is so ironic now.
I thought it was very funny because both of us having lived in both places, it is nice to kind of see the different look. And it is clearly, even for the mid-70s, a caricature of what Hollywood was like.
Right.
But it's still very funny.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of the, you know, the idea and Woody Allen's very obviously real feelings about Los Angeles that he's always had.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he only made his films in New York for, you know, probably through like into the 90s. And then he started like, you know, they started to be setting and, you know, being set in like London and Blue Jasmine was in San Francisco, you know, so, you know, but they were always like, well, we'll just film him in New York. And you know, he had his cast of his crew that he always used. But anyway, so seeing it in that context is always interesting.
True.
You know, I love seeing, you know, I mean, just the New York of the 70s is a very different New York than, you know, especially, well, the present day, but even like 20 years later, like in the 90s when, you know, Giuliani started sweeping everything under the rug and then, you know, dumping the rug in the East River, you know. I still don't know where the squeegee guys went at that point. They're back now, but I don't know where they were during all that time. So in terms of the movie in general, I want to talk about what our thoughts were about the movie before we'd seen it and how that measured up with what we actually saw. I'll ask you first.
Flobo. Yeah, for sure. So I tend to, even though I've seen a couple of Woody Allen movies, I tend to shy away from Woody Allen's work only because it's almost like his on-screen characters were very hard to be immersed with, right? You had his neuroses and his...
Wait, so you didn't feel like you had anything in common with Woody Allen?
I mean, as I get older, I do. That's so awesome. Great point. But in my 20s, I'm like, oh, who's this guy who's so fussy about everything? And that's probably contributing to why I've only seen a handful of his films.
Sure.
So in that way, I was able to say, okay, but besides the fact of how he delivers it, I understand where he's coming from or why we all want love, but we don't know what to say, what we want, and things like that. So in a lot of ways, the movie did exceed my expectations, but it does take a little bit of that bar to clear. I'm like, all right, man, this is pure Woody. Just get used to that.
Right, and I think it's a great film in the way that, like, clearly it's about a relationship, and clearly it's Woody Allen, so the relationship is not going to go well. He will certainly sleep with someone else at some point.
Because I know, he has a lot in this movie.
Look, good for Woody. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, all right.
I thought it was great that he had the two wives. The first wife being played by the delightful Carol Kane, who it was great to see.
She was a nice lady. Yeah. Her character was
Allison, who worked on a campaign. I forget now who was running, but that's not entirely that important. So yeah, and it basically was what I expected. The thing that struck me is it is a very primitive, in a good sense. It's a simplified version of a film from the last 15 years that I really liked. The Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zoe Deschanel, 500 Days of Summer. I think that's a great movie.
Okay.
It's this movie.
Okay, yeah.
It's the relationship, the highs and lows, but not shown sequentially. It jumps around in time. So in that way, it's actually very much the same. And I'm like, oh, I should have seen Annie Hall before I saw that.
Okay, yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, because what they did, it's very cool, and they make a bigger deal about, you know, jumping around. But it's I think, look, anybody's been in a relationship. We haven't all been in a relationship with either Diane Keaton or Woody Allen, but you can relate because you can relate for the moments where it's good, and then, man, when it's bad, you're like the moment when they're sitting on the airplane and they're both thinking the exact opposite of what they're actually saying, and they're like, no, I can't break up with her, she'd be devastated. It's like, oh no, he needs me. But then they have the honest moment of like, yeah, this isn't working.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So a lot of that is I found to be very relatable. And, you know, the tone is very funny throughout, you know. And as a comedian, Flobo, I'm wondering, do you appreciate the way that he's able to incorporate, you know, material, one, into the dialogue, two, into sort of being this omniscient narrator talking to us, the audience, implementing jokes, and then also, of course, there's times where he's literally on stage performing,
right,
telling jokes. Did you feel that that worked? Because there's movies where comedians do that, and you see it more on television. You know, for every Seinfeld, there were 20 other comedians who had sitcoms that it didn't work when they tried to stick their bits into it. But what did you think about that in this film?
Yeah, overall, it worked. The thing is, if the movie did not have him performing on stage, it wouldn't have been a deal breaker to me. I felt like he had enough strength of a character and enough of a dynamic with all the other characters in there that it would have worked. But by itself, the fact he's on stage, icing on the cake. Totally fine, because again, as a comic, I totally see the feeling of being nervous or, hey, you can't put me next to this guy. He's a comedian. He's already getting laughs.
I thought that was great.
He's going to blow the audience. So that's always great. What it rolls back into, though, is that here's this person that thinks he can create what he wants in his brain at all times. He has control at all times. And as soon as things go astray, it's, I can't have this. So to me, that was kind of like, oh, his problems, his flaws goes beyond relationships. It goes beyond, because that's the way he is. So I thought it was a bit of an underscore there.
Yeah. And I think, look, the dialogue is very funny. I mean, some of it you can isolate, like, oh yeah, this could be something that you say on stage, but just some of the turns of phrase that he uses, you know, when Annie shows up late, you know, he's like, what'd you do? Come by the way of the Panama Canal? I'm sitting here with the cast of The Godfather. Those guys are recognizing him. But then my favorite is when the guy who is the very loud film critic, not literal film critic, standing behind him, he looks at the camera and he says, what I wouldn't give for a sock full of horse manure.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's just a great turn of phrase.
Are you a curmudgeon as well?
You know, well, for those that don't know, by the way, Flobo and I, over on our sister network, AfterBuzz TV, Mondays at 2 Pacific, we do the Curb Your Enthusiasm after show. And yes, I can certainly – I have a very curmudgeonly side that the side is much smaller. You know, I've been married for 10 years and I have two adorable children. So it's more that I'm just tired all the time. But, I you know, it's exhausting to be curmudgeonly all the time.
Fair enough.
You know, sometimes it's easier to be like, yeah, I'll just fine.
Just roll with it.
I'll just do that. The line that I was looking for, by the way, in my head, I found in my notes when he's first talking about L.A. and he's like, the only cultural advantage in L.A. is being able to make a right on a red, which made me laugh.
I was in upstate New York one time and I was at a red light and someone honked me. Yeah. Did not turn around. I had no idea. Like,
don't you know what red means?
I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. So I thought that it was very funny. And look, there's some interesting cast that show up throughout the course of the movie that surprised me. I had no idea Christopher Walken was in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
But boy, was I excited to see him. And, you know, like a very young Christopher Walken. Yeah. And just, you know, if there was ever going to be a guy who talks about, you know, driving and thinking about, you know, steering into the oncoming headlights and he can already envision the explosion. Yeah. And, of course, Woody Allen has to then get in the car with him when he's driving.
Can I say that? I saw that. I was like, hey, it's Meg Zorn. That's the first thing I said. That even – okay.
So and, you know, look, I think that it's – there are some very identifiable moments. It's funny because the notion of psychotherapy, you know, they refer to it as going to your analyst, which it seems to be a very – old school New York way of saying going to a psychiatrist is not really, you know, but it was seen as unusual. And when she asked if he'd been going for a while, it's like only 15 years.
Yeah, making good progress.
Yeah. Look, and a lot of creative people, you know, I think Howard Stern goes 4 days a week, you know, so it's just like, helps. It helps people. And you know what? It's very successful creative people. It seems to be particularly useful. Well, I know I can understand it. And I thought it was interesting because that was another one of those times where we got the split screen and what she was saying and what he was saying were very different, best summed up as, well, how often do you have sex? And he's like, only 3 times a week. And she says, all the time, like 3 times a week. Yeah. And it's so funny to get both sides of it, you know? And I think that's what the film does well. And you have to look at it through the jeweler's loop of 1977 when it was released because of so many movies that came after it. But what are some of the things that stood out for you, Flobo?
Yeah, I think it's how naturalistic it was. I mean, this is 15, 20 years removed from those screwball comedies of the 50s and 60s where it's like, I'm mad about your baby. Smooch, smooch, smooch. it's always good to talk about breakups and makeups, but the decline is always where the heartbreak really happens. I just got out of a relationship that almost lasted 7 years, and it was amicable. But the last 3 months where we're trying to go in the car for drive and say, what did it go wrong? What did it break down? Was it something I did? It was all her. That balance hardly ever got talked about in film until really this one, in a way where it was relatable, but it wasn't a buzzkill either, where it was like, man, this Woody Allen guy, he used to go to a shrink. It was, okay, I understand why that happened. So.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, even after they're broken up and he's trying, you know, he's at the rented beach house with a different woman and they got the lobsters and he's trying to recreate the magic. I mean, I think that, you know, they don't spend too much time on it. It's just a reminder of like, yeah, when you move on to the next relationship, you're not going to really be able to rekindle those exact feelings. Just hopefully you find someone that you feel differently about.
That's never true.
Yeah. I did enjoy referencing back to Annie's family back in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. sitting there with the family and just how we've established that Grammy Hall hates Jews.
Right.
And so, of course, she sees him as like an Orthodox rabbi.
Right.
And just doesn't really, you know, just everything he says, it seems like he can't really say the right thing. So I don't know. I find a lot of it I think is very relatable, you know, just all across the board.
There's a little bit about, well, he's Jewish. There's the whole Jewish identity thing. But I won't go into into it because I'm not Jewish, but I feel like when we're meeting someone in their family for the first time, we want someone on some level to make us better. Better people, better caregivers, better providers. We want someone to make us better, right? And then, so when you meet their family and they look for their approval, anything you're just a little bit insecure about is on the top of your brain, whether it's your size, your color, your weight, your background, how Jewish you are, how New York you are, whatever. And that was pitch perfect because it really was just a dinner on the textual side, but it really was uncomfortable for Alvy.
Right. And I was kind of wondering your thoughts on... I think it's handled in a way that nobody gave it a second thought in 1977 or in, honestly, a lot of the time since then. It doesn't heavily deal with race, but then comments are sort of made offhand. The one that comes to mind is that Annie has that black soap.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, I bathe it every day. What are you doing, a minstrel show?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's not like even an outrage now, but there were moments like that. It's not the only one. That's just the one that comes to mind. There were times that they dealt with race where you're like, yeah, they probably would just stay away from it. Did you feel that at all watching it the other day?
I'm so glad you brought up that particular joke because I was like, yikes, that's definitely a product of its time.
You know what I mean? Like it's not like I'm not going to cancel people associated with the movie, right. But it's like, ooh.
Yeah. It's way too risky now.
Yeah.
And I hate to sound like the old guy in a rocking chair, like, oh, we've all changed. But when things, we're living now, and this is my soapbox moment.
That's all right. That's why we're here.
But we're living now with social media where you can clip things out and show with context, that looks like completely like out of line, right? But in the course of the movie, because we saw this person totally get mad and say the mafia joke earlier with the two guys who recognize them, you're kind of like, okay, I'm on board. That's the kind of character he is. He's an old curmudgeon, as we say. So that joke would not fly today. But even in that context, I was like,
that's why I wanted to ask you. And there are more, but that was the one that I wrote down that I remembered. And I mean, look, I think a lot of it is.
By the way, a good Woody Allen impression. I like your impression of stuff.
I don't even think I'd ever tried one before, you should see my Montgomery Clift. But in any case, I thought that I'm sorry. I have to make sure I get in one of my favorite jokes in the whole movie. Don't knock masturbation. I'm having sex with someone I love. I was just like, wow, he really just said that. That's so perfect.
You gotta have a bumper sticker.
What kind of reaction do you get when people try to, what? I cannot believe what that car says.
Love yourself first, man.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's just, I do think that it's, I don't know. I like them showing them starting to get on different tracks. You know, they break up for a little bit. And Shelley Duvall, amazing as the obnoxious rock and roll journalist.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just talking about, Dylan and Mick's birthday and just all of the, the backhanded comments that he has about it, So I thought was very funny. That was another great, I had no idea she was in the movie, so it was great to see her.
Granted, we all have dated someone who basically equates her self-worth to things they've done. Now who they are? And that looks pretty
annoying. I'm usually that person that someone else is dating.
So Mick Jagger, yeah.
Yeah, well, if only. Right. I think that there's a lot of that in it, when you're seeing them sort of on different paths, though. And I sort of like to reference back to the second scene at the beach house with this other woman and who's just like, why are you freaking out about the lobster? Just put them in the pot. Just doesn't get it.
Right.
She doesn't get any of the jokes he's making.
Right.
She doesn't understand anything about him. And I think that that's a great stark contrast of, you really thought that everything was so terrible. I think that the film does a great job. And look, very succinctly, it's a solid 90-minute movie, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's like a drive-by. If it's a 90-minute movie, it's probably starring Adam Sandler.
Right.
I mean, comedian Adam Sandler, not Uncut Gems Adam Sandler.
Sure.
But I think that it's, I don't know, I think that it kind of hit all the right notes, and it doesn't totally bum you out at the end.
Right.
I think that it has the nice coda towards the end where he's turned it into a play, but he gives himself the happy ending that he didn't actually get. It's like, no, I will come back with you, which, yeah, of course is like, you know, the dialogue's exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like, no, I'm going to come back with you. He's like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Of course.
Everything she said leading up to it. Man,
we've all done that. In, yeah, our, in our mind's eye, it's like, it would be so much different if she said yes and, yeah, and that happened the way it is. And you know, you're right. It's not the happy ending in the traditional sense. There's no sweeping swell of music. There's no like, I love you, you know, snookums and kiss, kiss, kiss. But there is something, there's something beautiful in the damage or what you saw, the survey, yeah, of it all. And it had it played it to black, it kind of would have been a bummer, but I think it would have been also would have worked. But the play put the saying, hey, look, we all do that thing in our brain. We try to revise how it would end and how it would be different.
Yeah, and I like the fact that he's like, oh, you know, I ran into her a few years later and we talked and everything was good. And what you don't really see, because it's such a wide shot, I thought this was a nice touch. She's with another guy. He's with another woman. We don't get to know either of their other people, which I think is great because it's like, it's kind of incidental. Yeah. And so I think it's good. Look, I mean, it depends on the breakup and it depends on how much time goes by. You know, I'm still friendly with my first girlfriend who, if I think really hard, I can figure I have not been dating her for 25, 26 years now. Yeah. Still be able to be very friendly with her, you know? So it just depends on how it ends. And I kind of like that it leaves on that note, you know, where it's like, no, they can still be good. I wanted to spend the last couple minutes here talking about the LA portion, which we touched on.
Before I do, I want to say a shout out to Yasha in the chat.
Yes, says, yes.
This is one of my favorite movies ever. Totally. And Annie Hall when Harry Met Sally are the top three
one of comedies
of all time. Yeah. Have you covered that on the network yet? Have you covered that?
I don't know if the network has covered it, but we haven't covered it on this show because my usual co-hosts are Rachel and Alexa. And if they haven't seen When Harry Met Sally, I would be like, what?
I know, right?
Look, Alexa's Italian and she hasn't seen Goodfellas. I'm like, I don't even understand you.
Mine is Jurassic Park. I haven't seen that one.
You know, I didn't see it until a few years ago, Jurassic
Park. It's weird, yeah.
It's because I missed it. Yeah. Like, it's like when it wasn't on the, you know, sometimes there's movies, and we'll talk about this as the series goes along, and hopefully, Phobo, you'll be able to come back once in a while. Sometimes the movie, everybody you knew already saw it. I'm like, there was an age where I'm like, I don't want to go see the movie by myself.
Right.
And then also, once a movie wasn't on the big screen anymore, I'm like, what TVs used to be like, the old, like, box shape, you know, plug the VHS in. I didn't want to see Jurassic Park on that size screen.
Wait 6 months for VHS.
Yeah, I was like, no. So they did a re-release probably in 2013 for, what, the 20th anniversary or whatever? Whenever it was. And I was like, okay, I'll see it now because I want to see it on the big screen.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, it's great. Sam Jackson, Wayne Knight.
Yeah,
whatever. And another name to get us back on track with Annie Hall. Jeff Goldblum.
Nice.
Who has a cameo.
Yeah.
But it's great. He's on phone. He's like, I've forgotten my mantra, which obviously they're dealing with sort of this faux spirituality from the late 60s, early to mid 70s. You know, everybody's dealing with auras and chakras and all this stuff. And, you know, even if that was true in LA at this point, I'm going to assume it's all heightened from Woody Allen's perspective from, you know, Manhattan, where he rules over the world. But I found it a perfect touch when you see these beautiful palm trees and, you know, bright blue sky, sunny day. They're driving with the top down and Christmas carols are blaring. Because I remember the first Christmas I was out here, the Christmas of 2003, it was like 80 degrees. I was in an outdoor shopping mall and they'd put up the Christmas lights around the palm trees. I'm like, no, this is just wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
And I think people from here or from other places maybe don't think of it that way. But specifically when you come from New York and you're in L.A. for the first time and it's Christmas, you're like, oh, to quote the song from Live Aid, do they know it's Christmas at all?
That's
I'll
go do you one better. I think when I moved to L.A. it was August of 2007. It had went 2.5 months before A Day of Rain. And I thought I was in a movie set. I thought I was in the Truman Show. I was like, wait, oh yeah, I forgot there's rain.
My old roommate and I, we had a moment where this was one of the first couple of years we were out here. We had to think back on when it rained, and it was probably late summer. I'm like, we think April.
Yeah.
You know, we think it had been like 5 months.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah. No, and it's crazy. And people that don't live out here don't, you know, don't quite get those things at all, you know. But I don't know. I think it's very funny. And so before we finish up entirely, I want to make sure we get time to talk about sort of the big point that we always make in this show. Did it live up to the hype for you? Did Annie Hall live up to the hype for you, Flobo, you personally?
Oh, man, that's a really hard question because romantic comedy and hype doesn't really go together usually.
Well, yeah, but it's very well regarded. I mean, you know, I would say that there can't possibly be a romantic comedy that is also Best Picture. Ryan in the booth, you tell me, when Harry Met Sally didn't win Best Picture.
Double-checking right now.
Maybe Sleepless in Seattle, but there's not going to be a lot. We'll put it that way. Yeah, so you can just take a look at the list of Academy winners. Yeah, we can go to the, it's not called the Kodak Theater anymore, the Dolby Theater. And as you go up the steps, it's all the Best Picture winners. So if we could just stroll through there and be like, you know, It Happened One Night from like 1931 is definitely a romantic comedy, but it's a screwball comedy. And it's also
different.
1931.
Kind of. So I think it does live life in that way because if you can't deny the fact that it's influence to other films in that genre. Yeah. I'm thinking of Along Came Polly, which is a very very like derivative version of this. But yes. The idea of the manic pixie dream girl, like you said, Five Days of Summer, all that things are pulled from that kind of film. I enjoy it. I probably will see it again. Definitely for me personally, when I will like rush to see again.
Yeah.
But it's not like a movie where I'm like I'm over it. You know.
I think it's great. I understand why it's so highly regarded, and it's probably the first Woody Allen movie that people saw, whether you know they saw it in that day or just like when you're going through those film lists of like, we'll start with Annie Hall. I just saw things that were more contemporary because of classes I was in. I do think Crimes and Misdemeanors is the first one that I saw because I saw it in a film class, and I still contend that that is my favorite. But I'm very interested in seeing this film again, you know, maybe with the perspective of another few years. I would be more inclined to see other Woody Allen movies that I haven't seen yet. And I know that there's another one that you haven't seen that you thought was this one, right?
Yeah, it was Manhattan.
You haven't seen Manhattan.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, if I were to go through the list, the filmography of Woody Allen, I would probably find a few. And then, you know, just sort of in closing, because we're looking at this from the modern day perspective, it's a little different, you know, when you see Woody Allen and just some of the things that come up. Because, look, there's controversy surrounding him. You know, he's been in a very long relationship with Sun Yi, who is now his – I believe that they got married. But he never actually married Mia Farrow.
Right.
But she was one of Mia Farrow's adoptive daughters.
Sure.
And in the time that that story broke, it was obviously a very big deal in sort of the early to mid-90s. You know, to make the point that they have been together and are still together today, you know, clearly that relationship starting in a way that I think a lot of people really don't understand. Others find, you know, possibly criminal and other allegations around him. It's hard to not consider those, but let me ask you first.
Yeah.
Did that shape the way you watched it at all, knowing this about his personal life, which obviously 1977 – not only did people not know it, it hadn't happened yet.
Sure. That specifically did not. I did hear about the rumors and rumblings that there there weren't few roles of color for his films, and it's hard to mention that. It reminds me of a story
let me just interrupt. Especially for a guy who sets all of his movies in New York.
It's like, right.
So you couldn't find any characters that could be African-American in any of your movies.
Yeah. And it's hard, too, because I know when at my film school, there was a big poster, Birth of a Nation. I complained about it, and they decided not to move it at the time. They officially moved it like 10 years later. That was a big point of contention for me, but the art versus the impact it has.
Right.
I don't knock anyone who decides to cancel Woody Allen for their own personal reasons, but the film was made before those things happened.
Yeah.
So if you're willing to put that aside, you will be in for an entertaining time. But there is a right a person should have as the audience to say.
No, you can feel however you want about someone. And, you know, even if you had seen the movie and they go, I don't like him anymore, now I don't want to watch it. Look, a really tricky one is Chinatown, which I think is a fantastic film.
Yeah.
But by the time I'd seen it, Roman Polanski had fled the country, you know, for raping a 13-year-old. I mean, you can try and put that in, you know, euphemize that, but why should you?
Yeah.
You know, and look, he gets celebrated. He gets standing ovations at the Oscars when he's not there. He's won Oscars. And it's really only in the last couple years that people start to say, like, oh, if we're going to be judging all of the terrible people of today, why are we giving a pass to Roman Polanski? You know, Roman Polanski's victim has long come to terms. She feels like, you know, he should be able to return to the country, all this. But it's not really up to her. You know, it's interesting that she's been able to make peace with it. But it's like, yeah, but the law still hasn't.
Sure.
So I can understand somebody never seeing Chinatown. I do find that to be a fantastic film, but if somebody told me, like, yeah, I can't watch it, I'm like, I can't blame you. You know what I mean?
Right. One of the good things or bad things or controversial things for any kind of artist is that your audience will bring their perspective and their perspective to your work and craft and their moral compass. So, again, if you want to have a standard yourself, it's good to keep it consistent across the board. But you can go to history and see so many people created things that were great, but by today's standard, would have been canceled as well. And Roman Polanski, I think I saw The Ghost Rider in theaters, didn't know about the controversy.
Right, sure.
And been going back and hear about it, you're like, oh, my goodness, it did change my perspective, but I can't say what I would do either way.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's I don't know. I honestly haven't seen that many Roman Polanski films, but that one was so highly regarded, and it's hard to turn down Jack Nicholson in his prime. You know?
Well, the first movie, the second one, not so much.
Oh, Two Jakes? No, I have not seen the Two Jakes. I've just seen one Jake.
Okay, yeah,
that's the only number of Jakes that I feel like I needed. Anyway, I thought it was good to inject a little seriousness there at the end, but. Flobo, I really appreciated having you here on the show, and please come back anytime that we're doing a movie that you haven't seen, of course. But until the next time people see you on this show, where can they find you?
Well, the steam music. Hey, you can follow me on Twitter at Flobo Boys, on Instagram at Flobito, and Flobito.com.
Yeah, Ryan is playing this on his 1988 Casio right now for us. And I'm Christian Blatt. You can find myself, Rachel Goodman, and Alexa Capiello back here next Tuesday at 2 Pacific for Stripes. A film that none of us have seen except Flobo has.
Hey.
So you will not. So you're disinvited.
Aww.
But you can find Flobo and I Thursday on the Star Trek Picard After Show over on AfterBuzz TV, and as we mentioned earlier, Mondays the Kirby Enthusiasm After Show. In any case, that is all the time we have now. Thank you so much, everybody in the chat. We always appreciate your impact. We'll see you next time at the movies.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.